and that tar, nicotine, and everything else, and you're smearing it on that most delicate organ in a human being, which is only one molecule, only one cell thick between the blood and the air, and that lung is a very delicate, very highly designed thing with roughly the area of a tennis court, all folded in there very nicely. So this very delicate organ, you're smearing all that chemistry on there day in and day out when you smoke cigarettes. Let me drop it. And we now slowly have admitted that you increase your chances of getting lung cancer tremendously if you're a smoker. We used to think it was the chemistry. Now you ask yourself the question, is it the radiation or is it the combination? Both are bad. And so the person who asked that question, Roy, on your chat room, assuming that the people who generate, who design and advertise and whatever, these machines that are doing x-ray scattering at airports for the TSA, assuming that they're telling the truth, and there's ways that they can be checked to the Bureau of Standards, if you know what I mean. You can verify whether or not they're telling you the truth as opposed to exaggerating. Let me drop. Assuming they're telling the truth, and the exposure is a small fraction of what you get at an x-ray, dental x-ray, or a small fraction of what you get when you take a flight from New York to California on an airliner. The next question for a person to ask themselves is, are they a smoker? Is anyone near them a smoker? Are they getting secondhand smoke? I mean, they may have the right idea to avoid radiation, but when you look at the total number of sources, like secondhand smoke, I have a friend who now is down to 15% of lung capacity. He, by the way, is a marathon runner. He's now down to 15% of lung capacity. He has never smoked. His wife is an extremely heavy smoker for the 40 years that they have been married. Good, close friend of mine. And so it is my belief that the passive smoke that he's been subjected to from his wife smoking is a contributing factor to his loss of lung capacity that he's been experiencing over the last 5 years. AC2GS, for any comments on all of the above, K2LIW in the tech back.
AC2GS. Well, you know, in my actual real life profession, you know, smoking has been the bane of my existence. It causes so many problems. Nicotine doesn't really cause cancer. Nicotine is a drug, and it's terrible for heart disease and a whole bunch of other things, and it's what really hooks people. But that's what nicotine does. It's the damn coal tars and the radiation, and you know, there's two ways that it's assaulting people's lungs. The one is just a carcinogen that just mutates your cells, and the other is an irritant and accelerant to increase the turnover of cells so that you have more mutations with a chance of cancer and emphysema, bronchitis. It goes on and on, heart disease. It goes on and on and on, unfortunately. I mean, there's a good reason why they call them coffin nails.
A premature child, you can give him a whole lot of oxygen, and it doesn't really solve the problem. A premature child has not yet developed the surfactant, a very important biochemical substance required for the lung, so that your pairs of alveoli, I think they're pronounced, so that they will open up equally. Alveoli, because of the laws of physics, which is called, I'll think of the name of it in a minute. Can't think of the guy's name. Two balloons, side by side, will not share the air supply. One will expand, the other will contract, unless there's a surfactant. So I'm wondering, does cigarette smoking disturb the generation of the surfactant in the lung? Is that one of the possible causative aggravating agents to emphysema? AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, you know, unfortunately, the answer is probably yes, but it does 10 billion other things. It's kind of like, well, if you throw in a nuclear bomb in a building, I mean, will the surface blow up before the structure melts. I mean, well, everything goes bad. So, yeah, the cells that probably produce the surfactant are damaged along with all kinds of structures, and that's what leads to the emphysema and the bronchitis, that all these things, you know, look, think of lungs as a healthy sponge instead of soaking up water, soaking up air. And if you blow out the little saccules, you get less and less air exchange, and people huff and puff away, and eventually there's just not enough surface area to transfer the oxygen into the blood supply, and that's why people walk around with oxygen tanks until that becomes pointless.
So I'd like to believe that our federal government, the nuclear agency, I can't think of the name of it right now, the American Nuclear Agency, that's in charge of testing these things, is keeping track of the amount of exposure TSA is creating of people that are going to fly on an airliner, and therefore they have approved these machines that are being used, and therefore we have reason to believe they're safe, and if we dig deep enough into the authorization process, I'd like to think that we will confirm that they are safe in the way they are intended to be used. Is that a leap of faith that you and I could make, Roy, or should we all go and do a little bit of research as to how these machines got approved? AC2GS, KQLIW.
Well, all I can tell you is I think that's covered with the Energy Department. The Energy Department is run by ex-Governor Perry, who I understand has a bachelor's degree in animal husbandry. So, you know, I don't know exactly what they're doing in the Department of Energy these days. If you believe the manufacturer, it's one thing, but of course there's a lot of people who don't believe the manufacturer and believe that even though it's a very low-level radiation, it's particularly bad for pregnant ladies, and so pregnant ladies have an out where they don't get irradiated. So, you know, buyer beware. I would urge caution on the part of everyone. Don't rely on government. Don't rely occasionally even on specialists. Check things for yourself.
It used to be called the Atomic Energy Commission. It's now got another name. And we do have to check from time to time. Even these well-sounding, well-intended agencies occasionally make an error. The biggest, most recent error I know of is at the Ground Zero area around the 9/11 incident was declared safe. And a tremendous number of people went there thinking they're doing good work, and they weren't informed enough to know that they should be wearing a very high-quality respirator in that environment. And those who did wear a respirator had to clean the filters on those respirators every couple of hours because the amount of stuff that went into those filters clogged them in a couple of hours. And a fair number of heroic, I'm going to call them, in quotes, people who didn't insist on using a respirator was breathing all that junk, depositing it on those lungs, and a significant number of those people are now suffering a number of medical conditions that they believe the 9/11 event and the recovery afterward was causing. So the Environmental Protection Agency, let me drop. The person, a woman who just, I can't think of her name, who had just recently been appointed the head of the Environmental Protection Agency for the state of New Jersey, her staff made a declaration that the environment of 9/11 was safe for people to be there. It was based on no real measurement. It was wrong. The error was not created viciously. The error was created because the people in charge didn't know that they didn't know what the problem was. And therefore, a lot of people got exposed to things they never should have been exposed to. AC2GS, K2RW, for any comment on all of the above.
Yeah, AC2GS. The problem is ignorance. Ignorance is all over the place, and it doesn't have to be mean-spirited. I think a lot of people do very stupid, dangerous things not out of any maliciousness, but out of a sheer lack of knowing what the hell they're doing and why what they're doing is wrong. But, that's why you got to educate people, and that's part of what this is all about here tonight.
So when it comes to confirming that the passive X-ray scatter machine the TSA uses at some airports, any idea where you and I would go next to confirm that reasonable measurements were made, reasonable standards were adhered to, and that the machines are safe by, we'd like to find out they're safe by 100-to-1 ratio. Where should we go next to confirm that, Roy? I don't know. AC2GS, K2IRW.
Well, unfortunately, it's the nature of our present time. We live in bubbles, and so there's one bubble where it's less dangerous than a banana, and it's another bubble where pregnant women shouldn't go anywhere near it. My guess is ultimately they will be phased out in favor of non-ionizing radiation. It's just a matter, I guess, of economics, or if they invent something even better that's non-ionizing. But I think eventually they're going to move to non-ionizing radiation just to be on the safe side of everything.
I'm with you on that one, Roy. Now, John said something that juggled my mind. He talks about the fact he eats a banana every day, and he's glad that it supplies him with potassium. I eat a half a banana or a banana every day. I'm getting that potassium. If I was getting leg cramps, are they typically caused by too much potassium or too little potassium? Would I be aggravating my leg cramps by eating a banana, or would I be aggravating my leg cramps by not eating enough bananas? Dr. Roy on that one first, and maybe I'll turn it over to John. AC2GS first, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, I guess this is the first edition of the Health Net. Lack of potassium causes muscle spasms and, to one degree or another, muscle weakness. High potassium causes other problems, heart arrhythmias and other nasty things, but not necessarily any cramps. So usually you have people who are taking some form of diuretic for blood pressure, congestive heart failure and such, and it depletes their body of potassium, and they usually complain of generally fatigue or cramps. So potassium from a banana is an excellent source.
Yeah, an awful lot of people have an attitude when it comes to pharmaceuticals. The attitude I think they sometimes have is that if a little is good, more is better. There's a ridiculous number of people who will take some pharmaceutical, develop faith in it, and double or triple the dosage, and they can get into an awful lot of trouble. In many cases, I think certain people can get into trouble by taking the recommended dosage of a pharmaceutical. I'm a person who's quite skeptical about pharmaceuticals. I happen to use none of them, and maybe I'm lucky at my old age. I'm able to survive taking no pharmaceuticals. But I'd like to believe the amount of potassium I get from a banana is a very safe amount. And even if I was overly enthusiastic and ate 3 bananas per day, I'd like to believe I cannot overdose myself on potassium with 3 bananas per day. Whereas many pharmaceuticals, the ingredients they contain are sometimes so darn concentrated, I can easily overdose myself. But if I'm using natural nutraceuticals like bananas, I want the answer to be, I'm not likely to overdose by that method. I'd like a confirmation on that, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Well, unfortunately, the answer is maybe sometimes. In the cases of bananas, you have to eat a lot of bananas to have any kind of ridiculous amount of potassium intake. And potassium intake is a normal part of life. So evolution has designed our kidneys to work beautifully. We put in too much potassium, our kidneys just urinate it out. So as long as you have good renal function, you really shouldn't have any problem with too much of anything. If the problem is too little of something, because there's no mechanism to kind of transmute it in your body. So it's not as much where you got the potassium from. It's, you know, I mean, I wouldn't inject it directly into your veins because your kidneys can't work that fast. But as long as you have a slow absorption, your kidneys will deal with it.
Although we're branching off here for, I'd like to believe, only a minute or two, we've got a good physician on some of the people who signed into the TechNet have got all kinds of capabilities. Roy happens to be a practicing physician with a number of years of experience, been through lots of medical training, I believe, and internship and so on. When it comes to the things that people frequently lack today, you just mentioned the fact that lacking something, the body can't generate it. And vitamin D seems to be the vitamin of the day, which an awful lot of people are told to take it because they lack it. From your experience, Roy, with people who live in our area, the New York City metropolitan area, is vitamin D one of the major things that people are lacking that they should worry about a little bit? AC2GS, K2LAW, and the TechNet?
Well, you know, fortunately, we live in a world of plenty. We live in a world of all kinds of food supplements thrown this way and that. You know, everyone and their brother takes a Flintstones multivitamin and what have you. So other than people who are on very bizarre, esoteric diets that limit them exceedingly, for the most part, you don't really pick up vitamin deficiencies. You know, I mean, the big vitamin deficiencies you used to catch in the ancient days were guys stuck on a ship for 6 months. So, you know, you don't see any of that. You know, you don't see scurvy. So I don't know. I've never really come across a person who really needed vitamin D supplements because they were just off the wall. But then I've never, thankfully, had patients who had very weird diets.
Yeah, there are people who are on weight control diets that sometimes are pretty extreme, where they take tremendous amounts of citrus things and whatever. I can't even think of the names of some of these diets, but I think some of the diets, for very brief periods of time, I think the body can tolerate. But once again, sometimes people develop the attitude of a little is good, more is better. And they will take one of these fairly drastic weight control diets, which is recommended to be used for, let's say, 2 weeks maximum, and they stretch it way beyond that. I think some of those individuals can get themselves in trouble. That's a guess on my part. AC2GS, K2LAW.
AC2GS. Well, the problem is you got it in both directions. You have the occasional person. Usually they do that more with over-the-counter stuff. You know, if 2 pills a day is good, 8 pills a day got to be better, even 16 pills. But it flips over with prescription products because of the same kind of attitude that you take to prescription products. There's a little bit of, gee, that's too strong, that's too powerful. It's not an unusual week where someone will bring me a pill bottle that should have expired 6 weeks ago, but it's half full. So, and of course, they swear up and down that they take the stuff. So sometimes they take too much, but a lot of times they take too little. And guess what? It doesn't work that way.
So I think you're saying you run into those conditions periodically where expired pharmaceuticals are still being used or not being taken in the recommended dosage. One of the frequent complaints that we hear on a number of recent articles, maybe they're well-written, maybe they're not well-written, suggests that modern-day physicians, in their training, get a tremendous amount of training with reference to pharmaceuticals and nowhere near the right amount of training when it comes to ordinary good nutrition. Lots of articles are written this way. Are those articles, from your point of view, Roy, exaggerations, or is there something there that the articles are suggesting where corrective action could be applied? AC2GS, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
Well, I think it's mild exaggeration. I think it's always good to be educated more about everything. And the problem that I have with people in general is, you know, it's a degree in medicine. It's not really a degree in nutrition. If you want to talk about only nutrition, there are nutritionists out there. But, you know, every so often I'm a little confused by people who kind of take the attitude of medicine, medicine, medicine. Why is it always medicine? Well, we're doctors of medicine. I hope that we don't overprescribe. I don't hope that no one misprescribes. But the concept, among other things, is to be able to call up the proper medicine that will help the quality and quantity of life.
I see your point, Roy. It's called a degree in medicine. But the major motivation of that medicine is to create good health in human beings. Nutrition is a part of that. So maybe the degree is a little bit more narrow band than it should be. If I wanted to exaggerate, there are people who have written articles along those lines, Roy, that to do no harm, to do mostly good, to make people healthy and happy, is the major motivation, I want to believe, of medical training. So the medical training maybe should go a little bit beyond just medicine, because good nutrition, a person could be getting the correct medicine, very poor nutrition, and he could be in a moderate amount of trouble. And the physician, in many cases, is in the position to recognize that the nutrition, the improper nutrition, is an aggravating factor that should be corrected. Maybe I'm not pushing this too far. Hey, C2GS, K2IZ.
Well, what can I tell you, Dick? I swore by Apollo. I'm sure there's very few people in the audience who took an oath by Apollo. But I took an oath by Apollo to do no harm, and I try my best not to do harm. We have nutritionists. I refer regularly to nutritionists. They're very nice people. They hand out the brochures. They talk about all manner of things. And unfortunately, about 5% of my patients take it to heart. The rest either don't care or they rationalize they're cheating away. Behavior is incredibly difficult to manage. People are their own worst enemies, unfortunately. And so I agree, nutrition is part of it. And that, for me, is what the nutritionist is involved in health care on a daily basis. And I try to do my best, although I tend to focus more on medical problems. Again, it's, you know, if you give a guy a hammer, he's going to look for a nail. Surgeons think in terms of what they can fix by operating. Medical doctors tend to think in terms of what they can fix with medicine, nutritionists with food. But we work them all together, and it seems to work for the most part.
I agree, Roy. And I know we've jumped into a number of crazy subjects tonight. And you guys who are listening to all of this jazz, you're allowed to vote on what you've heard. Hey, I want to hear more of this. I want to hear less of that. I mean, the protocol that we go through on the TechNet, questions about ham radio equipment, now physics questions, and the space report, which we're about to go to late. That came about from various people making suggestions, various people coming forward with the capability, and here we are. And you're allowed to write Roy with his mailbag, with his chat room. Roy, and you're allowed to make suggestions. I wish you guys would do this and do more of this and less of that. You're allowed to make suggestions. So before we go over to the space report, which we're a little bit late on, Roy, I think you should repeat your mailbag address and maybe tell people if they want to use the chat room instead, how to go there. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, it's something I have to learn to do at the beginning of this thing, is to mention the mailbag address. The mailbag address is technet at, my call sign, ac2gs.com. That's technet at alphacharlie2gulfsierra.com. Now, if you want to, for some odd reason, leave me a message inside the chat room, which is a little awkward, but if you want to, You could either go to Limark.org and look for the chat room link and click on and join it and leave your little message, or I made you an alias to make it a little bit easier. All you have to do is go up to the top of your web browser and type in chat.ac2gs.com, and it'll take you directly to the chat room. And you can leave your message there. But I would tend to prefer them in email form, but either way, we'll accept them.
Question about the chat room. Right ahead, Paul. I went there once, but that was a long time ago. Now, I looked at it the other day, and it looks like you have to put some kind of, you know, either your name or your call sign. What do you put in? You just put in your call sign as... Do you have to come up with a password? What kind of a thing is that about? Do you know, Roy?
It's no password. You can use any name you feel like. I use my call sign, but the people who left questions just put in strange names. The one gentleman called himself Emoji. Another called himself Cult. You could write anything you want, and it'll accept anything.
Okay, very good. And once again, that's chat.ac2gs.com. Do I have that correct, Roy?
Roger, roger.
Okay, so technet.ac2gs.com is the mailbag. Chat.ac2gs.com is the chat room. So by any of these means, you can get your message across. That you want us to do more of this and less of that, and go away entirely. You're allowed to say that, and if a majority of people say it, we'll listen. This is your show. There are people who complain sometimes that, hey, the TechNet doesn't have interesting subjects. Well, you guys didn't ask interesting questions. For the most part, we're not generating. Oh, tonight we generated some physics questions, but yes, for the most part, we don't generate the subject of discussion. The majority of the subjects being discussed, at least in the beginning of the TechNet, are a function of the questions you guys ask. Okay, time for the late Space Report, and this is going to be Space Report number 235, Whiskey 2, Sierra, November, Paul, the Space Report Maven, K2IW, you got it, Paul. What is NASA doing this week?
Okay, this is WS2N, and great topics tonight. There's no way you're going to fall asleep tonight, so very, very good. The orbital ATK, I've talked about them many times. They launch rockets mainly now from Virginia, in Wallops Island, Virginia. And, you know, they now have contracts with NASA to bring up the Cygnus spacecraft to the International Space Station. Orbital ATK has been around for decades, and sometimes under actually different names, but they've been in the space business for decades, and they have launch facilities now in California, and they've just recently launched a rocket from Florida. But Wallops Island is their main location because they launched the Antares rocket there, and it will be going up this Saturday, as long as it's not scrubbed for any reason. They're launching about 7,000 pounds to the International Space Station. On board they'll have everything from clothes to food to science experiments, they'll be launching early in the morning on Saturday, 7:37 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We should be able to see it if you go out there. Let me drop it. They have new engines. It'll be the second time the Antares launches with these new engines. They're called RD-181s. They're Russian built. They replaced their original old engines. NK-33, which were also Russian engines, but they were defective, and they got rid of all of them, and they've switched these much more powerful RD-181s, also kerosene fuel, liquid oxygen engines, and much more powerful than the original Antares rocket. So that's why they can bring up more payload. They first started bringing up like 4,000 or 5,000 pounds. Now they're up to the 7,000, about 7,000 pounds with the Cygnus spacecraft. Now, if you go out there at 7:37 in the morning and you look to the south, a little bit west, and you should be able to see there's actually two engines, two RD-181s at the bottom of that engine, bottom of that first stage when it goes up. And it'll go about 15, a little higher than 15 degrees off the horizon if you look in that direction. And then because it's going out to the ocean in that direction, that's as high as it's going to get in, you know, from our point of view. You know, if it was coming toward land, yeah, it would go right over us, but it's not. It launches from Virginia, goes out over the ocean in a 51.6 degree inclination, so it's going to go east and, you know, south, southeast. But the last time they launched was at night, and a lot of people did get to see it. And that was about a year ago with the same engine. Let me drop it. On board, they have all kinds of scientific equipment, antibiotic resistance tests they're going to run, and when they get it attached to the International Space Station, and the astronauts, the six of them up there now, start unloading everything. They're going to come. They've got an optical CubeSat they're going to be bringing into the station, and eventually, you know, maybe a month or two from now, they'll launch them from the Kaibo Japanese module. They have an airlock over there that they'll send them out. They have a half a dozen different CubeSats, different experiments on each one. So some kind of new communication system. They're going to launch those on the CubeSats to see if they can improve the amount of data that they can transfer from one location to another. And plenty of stuff for the astronauts themselves. This is one of the many cargo vehicles that go up to the space station. They have the Progress cargo vehicle from Russia. They have the Falcon 9 takes up the Dragon spacecraft for SpaceX. Then they have the HTV that gets launched from Japan once a year. So all these different vehicles go up to the International Space Station to supply it on a regular basis. So also down in Kennedy last week, actually, that was Monday, I remember seeing that go off. They had a Falcon 9 go off from SpaceX, taking up a Korean satellite from Launch Complex 39A. And it was successful. They sent it into geosynchronous orbit, 23,000 miles above the Earth. And it was a brand new rocket. They're starting to reuse the boosters, but this one was brand new. And they are saving these things. It came back and launched successfully. And when it came back, instead of bringing the first stage booster all the way back to Cape Canaveral, because it was a geosynchronous orbit, it was going very far out to the ocean. It came down about 400 miles out to sea and landed on the autonomous drone ship. Now, this is the 19th time that SpaceX has saved these 150-foot tall boosters, 12 feet in diameter, with 9 rocket engines on the bottom. 19 successful landings. Out of the 19, they saved one. They put one in Hawthorne, California. That's their mission control. And then three of them, they've actually on other boosters, other rockets and used as a reusable booster, and successfully have launched those and recovered those. So they're playing around with their 18 of these boosters, keeping them in different locations throughout Cape Canaveral or Vandenberg Air Force Base, and also back at McGregor, Texas. That's where they test all the boosters and keep all the boosters. So they're going to take two of these that they've stored, and they've already sent them to Florida because they're going to be attached to one main core. So you're going to have three of these Falcon 9s going off at one time in December. It's scheduled probably for the second week of December. Hopefully it goes off. It's going to be launched from the same complex that this Korean rocket has taken off from. Launch complex 39A. 39A is the famous one that launched all the manned Apollo missions to the moon, and it also launched over half the amount of shuttle flights, and it were roughly 135 shuttle flights. Over half of them launched from that one complex, launch complex 39A. So SpaceX is kind of like renting it for the next 20 years from NASA. And they're doing a good job with it. So they've been launching these single rockets off. This is about the 17th or 18th rocket they've launched from 39A. Since they've started launching from that complex, they were launching from another complex down in Cape Canaveral called Launch Complex 40. But SpaceX blew that one up accidentally a couple of years ago, back in September, around two Septembers ago, 2015. They had a satellite that was supposed to go up from Israel, and the thing blew up when they were just testing the rocket engines. They weren't even ready to go, and it took out that whole complex. They haven't launched anything from there since. They've been rebuilding it. Now they've gotten to the stage where it's almost completely done, and they'll be able to launch these single rockets back at Launch Complex 40 instead of 39A, where they have been launching all these flights from. Since they can do that, this probably next month, that allows the rebuilding of Launch Complex 39A to do two things. They want to be able to launch this these three Falcon 9 rockets at one time. It's called the Falcon 9 Heavy. And now Elon Musk calls it the Falcon Heavy. But it's 27 engines that will be launched lit off almost at the exact same time. There's milliseconds in between each rocket that gets fired. But when we look at it, it's going to look like 27 engines at one time. It'll be the most powerful rocket to be launched in the whole world, except for the earlier launches of the Saturn V rocket. So that should be pretty interesting. Also, Launch Complex 39A will be the one, another year or so from now, they'll be testing the first manned spacecraft to be launched from American soil, and that will probably take place toward the end of 2018, maybe the beginning of 2019, if there's any delays in the manifest. So that's pretty much it for the main, for all the main launches that are coming up. There's other things that are going on, not to do with the manned missions. I finally found out how many cameras are going to be on the Mars 2020 rover. We have another rover that's going to be launched a couple of years from now that will, it kind of looks like Curiosity. It's about the same size and everything, but it's much more advanced, and it turns out it will have 23 cameras on board, where the The old one had 17 cameras on Curiosity. So it's going to be a lot more effective than the other one. And that's been enough. You know, naturally, we keep upgrading the list. You know, Mars rovers, the MERs, the Mars exploration rovers, Opportunity and Spirit. You know, they had 10 cameras each. So, and then back in 1997, about 20 years ago, when Pathfinder landed on the on that planet, it released a rover called Sojourner. Sojourner had two cameras on board. So you see there's a steady progression. Two cameras, 10 for the Mars Spirit and Opportunity, 17 for Curiosity, and now 23 cameras, all color cameras this time too. Even the navigation cameras that have been on the previous rovers used to be black and white, and now they're all going to be color cameras. Back to you, Dick, for any comments or questions before the end of the net. This is WS2N for the space report for the TechNet.
T2LR.
Miss LR, go right ahead.
Hi, this is AC2LR. Paul, I have a couple of questions. What time this coming Saturday did you say the launch coming out of Virginia would be? That's question number one. And my handle is K, by the way. And the other question is, what are the extra 13 cameras going to be used for? Anything, any specific jobs, or just more 360-degree imaging? AC2LR.
Okay, Kay, yeah, 7:37 a.m. And I, you know, let's hope there's no scrubs of that mission. They've been pretty good lately, but you never know. Weather could always be a factor. So, presently, 7:37 in the morning. So, you don't have to worry about the. It's not like the space station going overhead where you have to worry about the light reflecting off of it. These sightings are actual engine exhaust coming out of the RD 181 engine. So that's the deal on that. And the rovers, well, I know they have like cameras near on the bottom. You know, you have these front and rear facing cameras, so now you're going to have probably the same amount for navigation. So that's four there. Then on the, they have this handheld device that has the drill on it and has the mirrors on it and all that stuff. That, you know, they give that a name. Everything has an acronym, but that's the MAHLI, you know, it's the Mars Hand Lens Imager, and that's got the drill, it's got a bunch of very sharp looking cameras on there, and they could, you know, they could look at things so small, you know, it's like a microscope on those things. So that's, you know, it's not going to be 13 more cameras, no, it's just, this one's going to have 20.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And up at the mesh, you have some extra cameras. You got the navigation cameras. They got a couple of mass cameras using, they need two of them for 3D. They have a new super, they call it a super cam, remote micro imaging camera. So it's going to actually have a zoom set up on it, where they didn't use a zoom on the Curiosity. They just used a tremendous amount of pixels, and then they actually use that as a Zoom, but they're actually going to have a Zoom on this thing. And then they have hazard cameras looking down, checking the wheels and all of that. And also, one or more is going to actually have video where, you know, what we see as movement and curiosity, it looks like video. It's a lot of pictures that are stitched and then sequenced together. This is going to have, you know, actual video. And then when it comes out of the atmosphere, out of the, you know, through the atmosphere, EDL they call it, EDL, when it comes through the atmosphere, entry, descent, and landing, I believe it is. They had cameras looking down last time. They're going to have them again at the land as they're coming into land. But they're also, for the first time, going to have cameras looking up, and I believe it's also going to be video. And for the first time, we'll see a parachute open up on another planet, you know, as it's coming down, you know, unfurling. They want to see that, you know, especially the engineers, they really want to see how that looks. Let me drop it. You know, it's not to say we haven't seen a fully deployed parachute. We have on another planet. When the Mars Phoenix came in and it deployed its parachute, we had the MRO above the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter in constant orbit around Mars. It actually took a picture of this completely unfurled parachute. And the same with Curiosity, too. It did take a picture of that parachute unfurled, but it's still a picture. The engineers want to get a hold of a video picture of this thing actually being deployed. So that's going to be pretty cool there when they send that telemetry back and pictures of what that looks like. Back to you, Kay. AC2LRWS2N.
Thank you. This sounds great. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about it.
And very good. And by the way, I want to thank you for sending that email about the Russian space program. I didn't get a chance to go, but I did read it, and very good. And they are coming a long way. But they have financial problems as well, but they're working on a spacecraft to replace the Soyuz. It's called the Federation. So I don't know if they had any information on that. Did you happen to get a chance to see that that event, okay?
I did go. It was last Wednesday at the ASLE meeting. At the Vanderbilt Planetarium. It was a really good talk. I don't remember him talking any... you know what? I was... 2 weeks ago is like a century ago. So much has happened in the past 2 weeks that I can't remember everything he said. He went through the history of how... it was about a 45-minute talk, and he described the history of how we first competed with Russia and the different spacecraft that failed. He was, in his research, he determined that the Russians had always been better metallurgists than we have, and that gave them advantages that we didn't have. He went into that science a little bit. I'm sure he mentioned it, but I can't remember. So I'm sorry, I'm bad at reporting. WS2N, this is AC2LR.
Okay, very good. Sounds like I missed a good one. Yeah, I know with the Russians, they went heavy duty, too. All their stuff is much more heavy duty than ours was in the beginning. Look at their Soyuz spacecraft. I mean, and the reason for it is these things were all derived from nuclear missiles, and their nuclear stuff was physically much more heavy. We had the ability to lighten our nuclear payloads. They didn't, so they compensated for bigger and better rockets. That's why their engines were just tremendous. Very big engines, but heavy-duty rockets that their spacecraft were much more heavy than what we built, you know. Very good. Dick, over to you. Any comments, questions? We got a few minutes left.
WS1. Yeah, Kay is giving me some other ideas of questions that I should be asking you. The 2020 rover on Mars, the update of the Curiosity, has more cameras. I'm pretty sure it's going to have quite a few more capabilities, like maybe drilling holes deeper into the Martian soil and setting up seismographs, or maybe other better ways of searching for either water or evidence that water was once on certain portions of Mars. You've done this in the past, and maybe you should refresh my memory a little bit. Do you know, is there an easy way you can describe to us some of the increased capability of the 2020 rover compared to Curiosity? WS2N, K2RIW, Grant Paul.
Yeah, and before I forget, there's one other camera I should have told Kay about, and that's inside the SAM unit. SAM, and they have a couple of different units inside the body of the rover itself. When the big arm goes out and scoops up dirt, it drills into a rock and takes that powder, it puts it into this chemical analyzing thing inside the body of the rover, and one of the units is called SAM, and sample analysis on Mars. So another acronym, but inside that, things are done in there. It's heated up and it goes through this process, a chemical processing. They do different testing. This time, they're going to have a camera inside that, so you can actually see what's going on when it's doing the testing after the material is deposited inside. So that's another big advancement. They'll have a better drill. The last drill has been out of operation for a couple of months. The mechanism that pushes the drill bit forward stopped working. So it could spin, but it can't push it forward. So now they came up with something else. Let me drop it. And they tested it on the test bed in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And what they're doing is they'll take the drill, and they're just going to use the arm itself, and the arm is going to push the drill into a rock. And they'll get that capability. They think that's going to be coming back in about a month. They haven't had communications with the rover, I think, for about a week or so, because right now Mars is behind the sun. And when the sun is in between, the sun gives off too much RF, and we can't copy any information. So the rover gets directed to do things. And it's actually operating, but it's storing all the information on its computer. It's got a tremendous amount of storage capability on the flash drives. So now, I guess now it's popped out on the other side. They're probably sending that information back. But this new rover will have a couple of extra sensors and different things that the other one didn't have. It's a lot of years different, so they improve on the senses. One of the things they're going to have is the ability to make these core. They're going to core bore, maybe 1/2-3/8 in diameter, core bore into the ground or into the rock, and take those samples and either analyze them on board, or scientists would love to get these things back to Earth, so they're going to have a storage compartment we're going to be able to put, you know, half a dozen of these core samples on the rover itself in case sometime in the future some spacecraft goes up there either with another rover or some other way of obtaining these things and take these samples from the rover after all these years of operation and put them on board and then have a sample return mission using those same samples that this thing dug out of the ground probably a decade earlier. You know, it was probably 10, 20 years by the time we get it back, but that's one of the future plans that they have for the rover. Back to you, Dick, WS1.
AC2LR.
Go ahead, Kate.
How are they going to get the samples back to Earth, Paul? This is AC2LR.
That's a future plan. Eventually, they have on, you know, it's nothing's paid for, but somewhere down the road, before we send men to the moon, to the Mars itself, they will have sample return missions, either independent of this rover, but if they have that capability to land near this thing and obtain those samples, they would like to bring it back on whatever mission we're talking about. There was one that was just planned but scrapped in 2018. For instance, Elon Musk wanted to send a spacecraft to land on Mars. He had this whole setup ready to go. It was going to come in with propulsion engines, these Super Draco engines, and they were going to land. You know, he was going to land it there. And then another 2 years, and 2 years after that, he was going to send more rockets similar to that. And one of them was going to have that capability. Theoretically, this thing was going to ride up to that vehicle after it landed. This rover would land right up next to it. It was going to have a robotic arm on that landing vehicle. It was going to take the samples out, put it inside, and they were going to have another rocket, a very small rocket, inside the Dragon spacecraft. You know, the top is going to open up, and this thing was going to shoot out of the Dragon like a guided missile. This was a plan of Elon Musk, and he was going forward, but, you know, I think he realized the complexity of it, and he kind of gave up with that. But you never know. You know, that guy comes up with things, and sometimes he says 2-3 years from now and maybe 5 years from now or 7 years from now. Back to Dick. We're running out of time. WS2N.
Yeah, we're about to be cut off very soon. That was TechNet number 1,675. That was Space Report number 275. Since there are 52 weeks per year, you divide that into 275, and Paul's been there for 5 years, 3 and a fraction months. Lots of space reports. Thank you, Paul. Turn it over to Roy. Maybe you got any closing comments. And do you feel uncomfortable when we start asking questions that get over to the edge of medicine in the physics section? AC2GS, for any other comments? K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
No, as long as they just don't get specific, and I don't want this to degenerate into the health net where someone wants to talk about their gallbladder. But generalizations, I'm more than happy to share my experiences. And I just want to thank you, Dick, and you, Paul. It's loads of fun being here and doing this, and I'm hoping that the people listening on the other end of the microphone are enjoying it. But please send us emails, technet@ac2gs.com. Tell us what you think. Tell us if there's any subject you want me to discuss, or else I'll have to tell you about the Higgs boson next week. So you've been warned.